Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith.
Without further ado, Sherry, would you like to introduce our guest?
I would absolutely love to. Rebecca Williams is a licensed marriage and family therapist in California. She runs a couples therapy practice where she teaches other therapists how to be great couples therapists. Rebecca specializes in mixed faith marriages and families, and her superpower is helping people connect across the religious secular divide. Rebecca's a former Mormon who left the faith over issues of gender inequality. And she's sometimes an angry feminist who wants to free everyone from the constraints of the white supremacist, I can't even say that next word, patriarchy. but we are very, very happy to have you join us, Rebecca. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back. Okay, so I wanted to start, if it's okay if I just jump right in.
Yeah, go for it.
I wanted to start today with just a little bit of a disclaimer. Because my exit out of religion was so much about gender inequality, when I was sitting down to prep my thoughts for this, I thought, I don't know that I'm even speaking from an entirely professional place. So mostly today I'm talking as Becca the person, and sometimes I'll be Rebecca the therapist, and I'll probably let you know when I'm speaking a little more from my professional expertise, because definitely redefining gender roles in relationships is something that I work with my clients all the time. But on this particular topic, I may be a little more, a little more irreverent than I would be if I was just speaking from my professional persona, I guess.
Yes, I can understand what you're saying, because it's has personal application to you too.
Oh, absolutely.
And it has personal application to me. So I kind of feel like you and I are going to have a therapy session and we just have a few hundred people watching in the background. But anyway, let's just not let that.
Jump right into it.
Yes, let's just jump right in.
Yeah, and this may be a talk where I have to sit in the back just listening and learning, to be perfectly honest.
There's a good application of some gender role stuff that men tend to ask all the questions and take up all the space. And you're welcome to be part of the discussion, but if you're taking over, we'll let you know.
Sounds good. Please put me in my place.
I think let's just jump right in to talking about what gender roles are. I mean, I already mentioned that was kind of what led me to leave my religion, is I got to a place where once I had learned some of this stuff about power and power dynamics and the inequality, like I couldn't unsee it.
Yeah.
Once I saw it in the organization, and I hadn't even lost my faith yet, but I stopped attending because I thought, I don't know how I continue to participate in my own oppression and have any like sense of self-respect.
Oh my gosh. Participate in your own oppression. I've never heard the phrase before. That's amazing.
That was what started my journey out of religion. It's like, I can't participate in this organization anymore. And then over a period of, a year or so, I was learning more and more and kind of deconverted. But that was initially when I stopped participation. It's like, I can't do this. I maintain my self-respect. Yeah.
Stop, because that is just revolutionizing for me. I hadn't thought of it from that point of view of participating in your own oppression. My goodness.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Really what it came down to for me is I understood enough of the structure of the religion that I was in that I knew there was no room for me to advocate, to say, hey, this needs to change. Hey, does anybody else see this? We need to shift. And I knew that me staying there was reinforcing all those dynamics and saying, in a way, I'm okay with this.
Right.
And I wasn't okay with that. So I couldn't go. I couldn't do it anymore.
Do you feel comfortable talking about maybe some specific things that you experienced, or maybe was that down further in the outline or the discussion?
You mean like what I was seeing in my faith community?
Yeah. Like if you continued in the faith community, what types of oppression would you be participating in? How would you be contributing to it?
Yeah, it was, I'll have to be a little thoughtful because I didn't have this prepared, but it had a lot to do with who made decisions, who had power and who had access to power. Women were never, ever, ever in a position of final authority. Even when they had some type of leadership-ish role, there was always a man over them who could override them. Mm. Women weren't allowed access to the money or to be even like auditors. Even a woman who was like professionally a CPA could not volunteer for the church to audit the books because they were women and didn't have access, weren't trustworthy or whatever.
Wow.
And there are some other ways that things that happened in the Mormon temple and stuff that I all of a sudden just saw so clearly and was like, oh no, that is not how I see myself always needing a man to be an intermediary between me and God. And like I said, at the time I hadn't lost my faith. It was just like, ooh, this is not my experience. I can't do this. Yeah.
The first thing that kind of comes to mind is that's how we treat children in that manner.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Never fully allowed to grow up.
Yeah. I'm just processing all that you're saying, Rebecca, because it was such a different experience for me. There were so many similarities in that the methods of controlling or oppressing women were the same. I have a Jehovah's Witness background, but it wasn't the trigger for me to recognize. My recognition of the oppression of women within the religion didn't come until after I'd left. And then I realized I was so conditioned to it that I accepted it without question, that I didn't recognize that I was being contained, I was being suppressed as an individual until afterwards. So I find it fascinating that you read that was the catalyst for you, recognizing that you weren't being given the space to be you, was the main reason to start then questioning your faith.
Yeah, there's a cross of the personal and professional there, because I was in graduate school at the time and had been in I was taking a class that was called Couples, Gender, and Power. And so I'm being trained, how to recognize these gender-based power dynamics in the clients that I see. And it was fascinating to me. And there was a lot that we were learning about how males tend to have power and decision-making power and how they wield that power that was really familiar. I'm like, oh yeah, I understand all of this. And like I said, once I learned to see it, I couldn't unsee it. It's like, yes. Oh, now I have language to talk about all of these things that I had experienced in a lifetime of being in the church. And it was, downhill from there.
Yeah.
Or uphill, depending on.
Education, it's a dangerous thing, right. Isn't it? That's fascinating.
At its base, what is a gender role? I mean, I know the two words and I can kind of assume what the two put together means, but be more specific, do you think?
Sure. So they're the prescriptions or scripts for how we are expected to be based on our gender, but most of the time it's really based on your biological sex. So, and this happens from birth, even before birth, right? We know the genitals of a fetus and we decide that we know all of these things about how that little human is going to be, what characteristics they're going to have, based on what their biological sex is. And as, little kids, we learn all of these things about what boys do, what girls do, what your roles are. And a lot of that is reinforced even in, parenting of young children, that adults tend to be much more receptive to girls' expressions of pain or fear they are comforted, but not maybe girls' anger or girls' assertiveness. Those things aren't welcome and they get shut down. And for men, it's often, or for little boys, it's often the reverse, that their expressions of anger, their assertiveness, their leadership, whatever, is welcomed and encouraged, but maybe their softness, their sadness, their fear is not. And those things are met with, don't do that. We don't, you shouldn't feel that way. And so we kind of, and it's often reinforced all around us too. This is what men do. These are the jobs that women have, whatever.
So it's a bit of like, this is, you can only fit inside this box. And it's not only something that I learn and grow up with as a kid, but it's also something that's externally reinforced constantly from society. Like, for example, if I think of the word secretary, a woman automatically comes to my head. And if I think of the term executive or, a man comes to mind just right off the bat. And we have a lot of language like salesman or trash man or something like that. Is this kind of within that? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's important to note that those things are culturally constructed and not biological or innate. Do we want to go into it all, the difference between like gender, biological sex, gender identity, gender expression?
I think that'd be kind of good. Just brief over. I would love to have an entire show about the difference between gender and sex one day, but if we can do a brief overview, I'd love that.
Right. This is the Cliff's Notes version. So biological sex is like what your genitals look like. Your gender is the culturally constructed thing that says this, or the gender role, right? This is who you're supposed to be, or the characteristics that we expect for you to have based on what those genitals look like. Your gender identity is how you identify as a person, you know, separate from what my genitals look like. Do I identify with being female, with being male, or with being neither? Because there are people who are non-binary and don't feel like they fit either one of those like binaries, I guess. And then your gender expression is different than your gender identity as well. You can have somebody who identifies as a woman and doesn't mean that they have to be girly or love makeup or like ascribe to the gender role. My way of womaning might be different than someone else's way of being a woman, and that would be their gender expression. Just like not every male is, matches all of the, what our particular culture might say, these are the stereotypically masculine traits. You can be a man who is, really into cars and mechanical things, or you can be a man who loves to cook, or you can be a man who is a super touchy-feely therapist, and those are all valid ways to be male and to express your maleness.
Rebecca, like the world is black and white, and what you're doing is you're making it much, much more complicated than it has. Come on. I took a class a few years ago, a kind of on this, and like I'm no expert at all, but I wanted to learn. And one of the things that really stuck with me is that sex is what's between your legs, and gender is what's between your ears.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
So, like more specific to the recovering from religion crowd. Religious communities often prescribe like gender roles on steroids. And for lots of us, this is where we had those gender roles taught to us or reinforced to us, like in religion and in the home often. And we may see, strict divisions of labor taught there in terms of what the different roles are, who has power, who's kept from power, who has power over whom, et cetera. And this is just like, this is me being me, the person, a plea from me. as you're going through this process of deconstructing your faith, please look at the patriarchy too. We can sometimes enact the harmful patterns that we learned in religion within communities of former believers as well. We take that sexism with us. We take that racism with us, whatever. We have such an opportunity to become better humans when we're willing to look at that stuff too and deconstruct it as well, which may or may not be completely related to religion.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned that, Rebecca, because it's, I found that while as I was deconverting, you, the doctrines, the first, well, for me it was the doctrine that got torn down. But then after that, it's more the behaviours. And that's when I started to reflect on things like the patriarchy and the roles and positions of power that each person had, and recognising that that needs to be torn down too. And that you can only really become your true authentic self by doing that, by tearing that all down. That is not, you don't have to fit this role. The other person doesn't have to fit, because you could also not be putting yourself in a role. You could be putting other people into that role. So tearing all of that down is just so important. So I hear you, girl. I hear you with that plea to do that. It needs to be done.
Yeah, and it's often more intimate and internal work than people expect.
Yeah.
When we really have like internalized the misogyny, and you know, we may find in our, you know, part of our deconversion process that unlearning the gender roles is part of that work is learning how to set boundaries with other people. It's learning how to claim the power and authority over your own life and your own decisions. It is, for a lot of men that I see, it's unlearning that I'm always right, that my needs always come first. And it doesn't mean that your needs are unimportant, but it's learning how to be in relationship with people in a more healthy way. Mm. There's a couples therapy modality that I like that talks about having power with rather than power over. And the patriarchy teaches us, especially in couple relationships, we like reenact these dynamics of one person having power over the other one. And sometimes when we leave religion, we just switch roles.
Yeah.
And it still is a power over dynamic. And what we're trying to do is relearn what does it mean to have power with someone else, where we learn to be sharing that power and authority. It's not a finite resource. But that me encouraging and empowering you and claiming my own power is something that actually elevates both of us.
Yes.
But it's a new language. It's learning a new way of thinking and being.
Completely. I'm scribbling notes here frantically, which is silly.
You can watch the recording later.
I know. I'm like, I can watch this again. Don't panic. But some of these expressions are just so, you capture so much in those few words, power with, not over. I really love that. And what you were saying about boundaries too, there's setting boundaries on how you want to be treated. Yes, I understand that. But there's also freeing yourself of boundaries, because you've been confined into set boundaries through your indoctrination, through your home, your church, your whatever it is that's helped you form those views. And so you have to actually drop those to then allow yourself to explore who you are, as you were mentioning earlier, identifying the differences between gender role, gender identity, gender expression, and then sexuality. As you investigate all of that, it does require you to just drop some boundaries to reset them, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, dropping some of the constraints that you were living by before.
Yes.
And then figuring out, who am I?
Yeah.
And how do I want to live my life? And what is it that really works for me as a person, as an individual?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The brain is so all over time.
As a cishet white guy, how can I, because I imagine I'm one of the worst types of perpetrators out there, how can I kind of start to identify some of this gender role stuff?
Yes, I have ideas about that. And I will say I'm particularly attuned to this stuff, Eric. And in the at least year now that I have had interaction with you, you're not a worst offender. Don't worry.
I think I have a lot to learn, though, still.
I appreciate that, and I also want to recognize that you're delightful to work with.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yes,
definitely.
Okay, so one of the very easiest things, if you want to like spot this gender role nonsense, is to reverse the genders on anything that you're thinking. I have some examples of this that, you know, women who want to snuggle are affectionate. They're just being womanly, but a man who wants to snuggle is needy. A married woman without a job is a homemaker or stay-at-home mom or something, but a married man without a job is a failure, a loser.
Oh my gosh.
What, so you reverse the gender and all of a sudden it's so clear.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that when my wife and I first got married, she wanted to kind of pursue her career. She is an amazing salesperson, and I just love watching her work. But one of my family members, not much long after got married, said, "Hey, you need to kind of stick around home, or else you're gonna emasculate him." And I want her to be happy. I had no idea that this person said that to her, but she started kind of operating that way. And we eventually had this conversation. I'm like, no, absolutely not. I love watching you work, but it was really shocking to hear that coming from this family member.
Yeah. You know, as you're talking, I'm remembering now when we first moved to this area, we moved because I was in graduate school and we were still in the church at the time, and people would, you know, getting to know you, "Oh, you know, what brought you to the area?" And we'd say graduate school, and without fail, everyone would look at my husband and go, "Oh, what are you studying?" He'd be like, "I'm done with school. We're here for her." Like, "I'm becoming a therapist. Hi, it's actually about me." And there was a period of time when my husband had been laid off from his job, and I had a full-time job. So I was working and he stayed home with our daughter from when she was, you know, 6 months to about three. And we had some comments from extended family members about how that was going to be really bad for her. And I was hurting the family and like neglecting my daughter by working. I thought, "You don't spend enough time with our daughter. She is fine. And we as a couple are meeting all of her needs, and she's growing healthy and great." And no one would have said a word if my husband had been working full time and I had been staying home with a baby and toddler. You reverse the genders, and all of a sudden, all of these unspoken assumptions become very clear.
Yeah,
that's a fantastic tool. Yeah, I can still struggle identifying it, but just reversing the roles, like, holy, and I think that would apply to a lot of other things that people experience, like the racial prejudices that many folks experience, as well as gender too. Wow, that's a pretty darn cool. It's easy to do too.
So easy, right?
Yeah.
I saw this since you brought up race stuff, with a conversation that was happening in an online group in my neighborhood, and someone was warning, there's this sketchy person walking around doing, when it, you know, described what the person looked like. And I thought, if the person was a white person, they would have just said, "Oh, someone's knocking on doors trying to sell stuff." It would not have shown up as, "There's a dangerous person in the neighborhood."
Right. So again, you've reversed right. it. And yes, it's an equalizer, I suppose,
right.
just levels right. the playing field. And I go back to an expression you've already used. It helps them with the power with rather than the power over, because
right.
you've taken away anything that can predispose or prejudge someone's role or position. Just by doing that reversal, it levels things out. I really like that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite things for kind of unlearning the gender-based stuff is to try a non-gendered term. So, and I do this very intentionally with the clients that I work with as well. So I want to just like see what comes to mind when I say that a person is mothering. this person is mothering a child, and how is that different from fathering a child? Pretty stark. Okay.
Yeah.
Right? Fathering a child is having sex.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean...
And mothering a child is like parenting.
Yeah.
That's a big difference. Like fathering a child, it's just like 2 minutes and that's it. Mothering a child is 20,
a lifetime.
30, 40 years. A lifetime, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm very conscious when I work with my clients that we talk about parenting. Even when I'm working with an individual client, I'll talk about, well, this is what you do to be a good parent. And you're going to show up and you care about your kids this way as a parent.
Yep.
And it equalizes them. And it puts, you know, the members of a heterosexual couple on equal playing field. The children aren't just the woman's responsibility. The children are also the man's responsibility. And when I draw that out and talk to them about it, men care about their kids too.
Of course.
Of course they do. They love their kids. They want to see them thrive. They want to feel close to them and to care for them and to see them grow and be great humans. But sometimes we lose sight of that when we're caught in these rigid prescriptions of what a man's job is supposed to be to, you know, provide or something. And it can be really empowering to kind of break free of that. I'm thinking of a male client that I work with right now, where in the dynamic of their relationship, he just is kind of the calmer, more level-headed one. And when the kids are having tantrums or in some kind of a crisis, like, he just naturally is better suited to be the parent who steps in and calms them down. And they've struggled some in their relationship because they both have bought into the idea that that's supposed to be the wife's job.
Right.
And it's been pretty freeing to see him just really take that on and go, you know what, but I'm good at it.
Yeah.
And it's okay for them as a parenting team to lean on what he's good at and let her do the things that she's good at and just like throw out what's supposed to be their job.
You are just reminding me of, I haven't connected the dots before until you said this, but my husband woke up out of his indoctrination from the J-Dubs before I did. And there was a subtle change in his language that you just triggered, not triggered, but you mentioned it, that the teamwork aspect. Sasha would say to me, this is what works for our team. Because what we were doing was not the prescribed JW family. I was working full time and I was pursuing my career, and that was a no-no within the religion. And Sasha was making it okay by saying, we are our own team. This is what works for us. And I hadn't actually connected that until you just said that. So there you go. It did have an impact on my deconversion that the roles were being changed and he was making it okay.
Right. And just that subtle change of language communicates that, like, this is okay.
Yeah. And that it's teamwork, that it's not about him being the man and me being the woman and having those defined roles. It's about two individuals, two humans, reaching an accord that works for them as a unit. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, what's the harm with this? Come on, it's been working for thousands and thousands of years. Why should we change? I mean, come on. It's a working system, right? Why should we change? What's the harm? What's the harm in all of this?
So the thing is, if you happen to be the person whose gender expression and gender identity really closely match the gender role that you've been given, it probably, like, you don't see it. It doesn't bug you. And that's, like, great and good for you. But when there's only one way to express your gender, if there's only one way to be a man or a woman, or when what is presented to you is a binary and you don't fit either one of them, we're put into these constrictive little boxes that don't work for us. And often the, like, intersection of the different parts of our identities are not accounted for in these, you know, traditional gender roles. And when we don't have the the ability to like fully express who we are as humans, sometimes that can come with mental health symptoms. We get anxiety, we feel a lot of depression, we might have, you know, increasing cognitive dissonance about who we are, the sense of like, I don't really fit, I don't know where I belong. And that sense of belonging is such a fundamental human need. Mm-hmm. And so you feel this like disconnection and loneliness. Mm-hmm. And along with that can also come a lot of shame, which can be really toxic to individuals when we know that we don't fit or that we somehow aren't who we're supposed to be. There's something wrong with me because I'm not who I'm supposed to be.
If all I experience are the binary, it would be very, very difficult for me to imagine someone who doesn't feel like either a male or a female. And it's just easy to just at first glance assume someone who looks like a male or a male has the experience between their ears like a male. But it's more complex than that, isn't it?
Mm. Absolutely.
What would be something that I could kind of do to maybe not have that initial reaction or that initial thought? Like, how can I train myself to work past those initial impressions?
So in meeting someone else, how do you train yourself to not code them according to traditional roles when you meet them? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that's exactly right. How would I be able to give someone the space when I'm working within my own mind? How would I be able to give someone that space right off the bat?
I would go back to using non-gendered terms. So this is a human. It's a person that I'm dealing with. And how might you, I mean, this is an honest question. Like, how would you treat someone differently if you looked at them and as you're getting to know someone, you just thought, I want to get to know this person rather than I need to get to know this man. I need to get to know this woman.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's, again, learning to break down those boundaries of identifying someone by a gender and just seeing the person. That's a really good skill to develop. I think it's hard for ones, though, that have come from such a rigid background. You've got to become aware of that or educate yourself that that's an issue. And I think once you've had that identified, it becomes a little bit easier to, when you meet new people or interact with anyone, that you're seeing a human. You're not identifying them by a sex or a gender or a role even.
Right.
You've got to practice at it.
I think along with that comes some humility in I don't know what someone else's experience is, which is often something that we need to unlearn when we've come from a faith community that is the one and only. The true has all the answers, right? We're used to being in a place where I can explain anything. I know everything about the world and I have all of the answers. And right. So we don't know what to do with a person who's sitting in front of me that has an experience that I don't.
Yes.
There's just some humility there in asking some questions or listening to someone and believing what they tell you about their experience. So I want to go back to some more ideas about like some motivation, how gender roles hurt, why you should want to change them. We talked about there not being allowed like full human expression. Often, like I said in the beginning, about how we react differently to boys and girls' emotional experiences, people learn to cut off parts of themselves. Mm. And sometimes it can be really dangerous for yourself and others. There are real severe consequences in our society, like mass shootings and stuff, when we have men and lots of white men who don't know how to deal with disappointment. They don't know how to deal with their sense of entitlement and I'm not getting what I want. And it's not that the feelings that they have are invalid or that they're, it's that they don't know what to do with them. We haven't get, we as a society have not given them the skills to know how to deal with those things. And so what they know to do is to act out in violence. Mm. And like, that's a thing that maybe seems a little bit dramatic, but like at the heart of it, it's not having emotional skills to deal with the things that, you know, disappointments that you have. I have a couple other like less serious examples of where gender roles and like buying into this stuff can be like dangerous to yourself or others. I talked about mental health outcomes already. I'm an outdoorsy kind of person. So these are my outdoorsy examples. I have a friend of mine who there was this hike she really wanted to do. It had sort of a scary overlook to it. And I hadn't talked to her in a few years, and she reached out to me specifically. I want to do this thing. I know that you're a hiker. Will you come with me? And I was like, yes, absolutely. I will come with you. We get up to the place. I'm looking around at all the people there. I clearly have like the gear. I'm wearing the clothing, the shoes, all of the things. And there was a part where you had to like step over maybe 18 inches or so out onto this rock. And she was scared. And that makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, kind of panicking a little bit. And she didn't want me to help her. She looked around and there was this guy over there who, in my opinion, didn't look like he really knew what he was doing. But she felt more comfortable in this physical situation having a male help her. And didn't want to take my advice, even though I am her friend and she brought me out here to do it, because I had this experience and I had gone over before her and came back and whatever. But in that moment of panic, all the gender scripts came up and it was, this is a physical thing. I need a man to help me. Mm-hmm. I need the strength of this man and not like I can rely on my friend.
That's interesting. Wow.
Isn't it? It's fascinating. Yeah. I was like, this is what's happening right now. Like, trust me, I'm here. This is why I'm here for you. And, you know, I have some other friends who are rock climbers and they were telling me that they were out in a place once and, you know, setting up a climb and these guys came by and wanted to be helpful. Oh, hey, can we do this for you? Can we help you out? And they were like, no, that's okay. We don't really need it. And they didn't listen. The guys still insisted that they needed to help until my friend was like, the thing that they were trying to do, if they had done it, would have, and we didn't say something, like we could have died. They really were putting our lives in danger, but didn't trust that these women who were out there with their gear really had the expertise. It was like, I need to rescue you and I need to help you. And my friend got really firm and was like, no, we're telling you, we don't need your help. Please stop. We need you to go away. And then the guys were all offended. Gosh, I was just trying to help. Well, that was fine. But if you had listened when we said the first time, no, we don't need any help. No, thanks. There's all this like ego tied up in, but I have this identity and I need to rescue you or I need to help you or you're obligated to accept my help or something like that.
Just shows how deeply embedded it is.
Mm-hmm.
That rescue mentality is something that I grew up with and I was given. It was akin to almost being chivalrous it seemed to be like a chivalry code, like you have mm-hmm. to rescue the maiden from the tower. And I remember like there was a moment thinking, why do I offer to open up doors for just women? Can I also do this? Can I just maybe do it because I'm a nice person for anybody who is walking through a door?
I love that example. And that's how I teach my kids, is that when you're going into a building and someone is coming behind you, you hold the door for the person behind you because that's what people do for each other.
Yeah.
And not that this is a thing that you should expect a man to do for you.
Yeah, it's courtesy.
Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't mean that we have to throw out everything that we've learned about what it is to be a good human. But we can look at it as what it is to be a good human, to live in community with other people, to treat other people with respect, regardless of their gender.
Mm. That kind of reminds me. Sorry, Eric, keep going.
No, absolutely. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking of the platinum rule versus the golden rule. About the golden rule, you're really enforcing your beliefs onto the other person, because you want to, you will treat them as you want to be treated. Whereas the platinum rule is about treating the person as they want to be treated. Yeah. And I find that that actually does tear down some of those stereotypes and the idea that you know it all, or that you know the best way of treating people, because we don't. We don't know how the other person would want to be treated. So, and you mentioned humility earlier. So I suppose having that humility, that openness of realizing that we don't know everything, but if we approach situations with the willingness to listen and hear the other person, then our genuineness or sincerity at the action will follow that should respect the other person.
Yeah, and I had a couple of thoughts about more specifically like power dynamics in intimate relationships, where we see this gender role nonsense kind of rear its head. and one of those is that sometimes buying into these things is a way that we avoid responsibility. I've seen a lot of men who will be like, well, I can't be held responsible for, you know, being insensitive or for saying things that are offensive, because like I'm a man and you're just being too sensitive. Mm. And so I don't have to take responsibility at all for how I am in relationship with other people because I'm a man. Or I see women who don't want to take responsibility for their own choices. They would rather outsource that to someone else. Mm. Let me find a man who can tell me what I should do here. And then I don't ever have to really own the consequences of my own choices. I can avoid responsibility and be a victim. And this is always someone else's problem.
So you're saying you've
met did I blow your brain, Eric?
You just described someone close to me who's been doing that to myself and my wife for a long, long time. And I can see it differently now. Thank you.
And sometimes couples can fall into these dynamics of having, you know, a woman does all of the emotional labor. So she mm-hmm. does the work of handling her feelings and helping her male partner with his feelings. And so then he doesn't, you know, like I said before, maybe have to know how to deal with his own disappointment. He doesn't have to deal with his own things because he comes home and the wife takes care of it for him. Or she does a lot of the unseen work of scheduling the family and keeping track of supplying the house and what we're out of and, you know, maintaining the friend relationships and whatever. But there's, you know, like double-edged swords, because there's ways that patriarchy hurts men too. Mm. And, you know, I see men in my practice, in the couples, you know, when they are, this decision-making stuff is put on them, it's really an unfair weight of responsibility. Maybe they don't really, they're kind of being crushed under the weight of, I have to provide for the family. I always have to know what to do. I always have to have the answer. And they don't really get to experience a true partnership with someone who's going to have their back when they always have to be this, you know, white knight on the horse.
Yeah, it's a pretty big expectation, isn't it?
It's huge. If you think about, again, take away the gender role and just think about one person.
Yeah.
In a two-people relationship holding all of that, it's not fair.
No.
Yeah, and what this is bringing to mind is back growing up in the 80s and 90s and even in the 2000s, I was the society told me that, you know, you don't have a mental disability. You don't. Medicine's not going to do anything, you big puss. You can fix this on your own. Whatever's going on in your head, you just don't have the willpower to fix. And that was like the manly thing to do. But I got to say, I'm taking meds now, and I am a hell of a lot happier than I was before. And so just screw my younger self for thinking that, because it's so much better on the other side. And it sounds like that's kind of what we're talking about here too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that goes back to this thing that like holding on to the strict gender roles doesn't allow you full human expression. It doesn't allow you to be vulnerable sometimes, you know, with males especially, it doesn't allow you to be vulnerable with other people and to benefit from connection. to benefit even sometimes from the expertise of other people, that you can ask for help, that you don't always have to have all of the answers, or that it's okay to not know things or to not be good at things, and to just own that.
Yeah, that's really important. That's good.
So you're saying gender roles can be stifling and they can be harmful. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That's been my experience too.
It's an excellent summary.
Wow.
Yeah. Should we talk about moving on from it then, what you do?
Absolutely.
Yes, that sounds great.
Mire down in all the shit and then we can get out of it. Okay. I think at the end, deconstructing gender roles doesn't have to mean taking away who you are. It's taking away all of this external stuff that was put on you and discovering who you've always been. The true you is underneath that stuff, and we're just going to clear away the crap that was given to you that isn't who you are and let the real you shine. And some of that might match. There may be some facets of you that match the gender roles that you were given, and that's fine. You don't have to completely deny those parts of yourself, but you're also allowed to be a full and complex human.
Well, kind of what you're describing is very scary. Like, if I have been being manly, quote unquote manly, for my entire life, and then like kind of I'm hearing you talk about this, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I might enjoy wearing a dress around town or something. It sounds really scary to me to kind of take that chance. I know right now I don't have that kind of confidence to express myself in that way if that were the case.
Yeah. And you know, you don't have to. You can start small. Oh, if you wanted to explore dressing differently, you could try doing that in your home first and see how it felt. And if you like it, then great. And if you don't, then that's okay. And it's also totally okay to, like I said, have parts of you that match the traditional gender roles and parts that don't.
Yeah, and I really like that. I think that's so important what you just said, because when you are leaving religion, there's, speaking from my own experience, you want to reject everything that you had before. Yeah. And you almost feel like you can't accept any of what you've left behind. And so I suppose then it may force you into a situation where your discomfort level could be quite extreme in rejecting all of the gender roles, when in actual fact, maybe you don't need to be putting that pressure and stress on yourself, because that is actually a natural fit to who you are. So taking the pressure away that you don't have to reject absolutely everything that you've come from, there may be parts of it that do work best for you and may work well with your partner. It's about exploring that and being able to identify it and not judge it. The not judging thing can be really hard, but
yeah,
not judging it and being okay to accept it, that if it works with your dynamic, that you don't have it, for whatever reason you prefer not to make decisions on your own, or some decisions on your own, you want to hear what your partner says about it, that's okay. It's totally all right. Yeah, I think that's really important what you just said, because that I can appreciate how it would be hard for someone who's left and wants to reject it all. They might be actually harming themselves there if they are rejecting everything, when that is part of the natural expression of who they are.
Yeah, so just speaking for myself as a case study of one, you know, I was raised to be a good Mormon woman, stay-at-home mom, bake the bread, do the crafts, care for the kids, volunteer with the PTA, right? Like, this is who I am supposed to be. And I definitely went through a process of figuring out, you know, rejecting some of that, and then maybe even experiencing a little bit of guilt when I came back around to like, but there are actually some of those things that I like. So I'm not a stay-at-home mom. I'm a business owner. And not just like, oh, I want to work, but like, I'm an entrepreneur. That is part of who I am that is very different from the gender role that I was given. But I also absolutely love being a mom. I love it. And I bake bread and I do some crafting, but my crafting is subversive crafting.
Oh, tell me more. What's this? What's subversive crafting?
Oh, I did a cross stitch recently that has like these little pretty flowers around it. That's like a thing you would expect to see from your grandma in your, you know, the home growing up, that she taught you these skills. And it says, carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man. Subversive crafting. I have a different cross stitch in my kitchen that says, well-behaved women rarely make history. I just love it. I love the feminist quote in the, you know, traditional female crafting thing.
Yes.
Right? And that's an awesome expression of like who I am as a person.
I love it. When you said subversive crafting, I was hoping you were going down the same thing, because I've discovered she's actually an ex-Mormon too, a postitch, who does some fantastic, just hilarious stuff. So I've done one of hers that's a quote from Gloria Steinem of, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. I've just completed that one. All the pretty flowers around it.
And I'll tell you, that's just my little case study of one. There's some things that I like that are traditionally feminine, and there are other things that are traditionally feminine that don't work for me. And like, that's okay. I can figure it out. And I will tell you, like, you can come back to who are you as a person? Where are your strengths? And lean into those things. It's okay. I hate cleaning. I outsource cleaning. I pay a house cleaner. There was a little bit of shame when I started that. No shame anymore. I don't like doing it. Mm-hmm. It's fine. I don't have to. I'm not less of a woman. I am not less valued. I don't have any shame around, this is a thing that I think that I was taught I was supposed to do that I don't like doing. That's okay.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, on the navigating this stuff within a marriage, my marriage got so much better and happier when I stopped expecting my husband to be ambitious and to be organized.
Yes.
Those are values that I have. And he was supposed to be like the head of the family. And I kept wanting him to do that and to express that. And that's just not who he is. And when I stopped expecting him to do that and to be that person, just owned, I am ambitious. I am really organized. And so if I want those things done, I got to do it myself. Things are so much happier. And corollary, though, he had to stop fighting me when I said, hey, we should do this thing. Because that was part of his unlearning gender roles, that his knee-jerk reaction is, if I say we should do this, that he'll go, no. Because he's supposed to be the one who calls the shots, right? That's what was modeled for him, is that he makes all the decisions. And so for a while, it was like, didn't even matter what I said. He would say no to it. And part of us coming to a happy place is that I stopped expecting him to be who he wasn't. And he embraced that. When he let me say, when he would go along with, like, Becca has good ideas, right? Yes. She wants the best for me. And he stopped just fighting it. Like, we were both happier.
Yes. Rebecca, the four of us with your hubby and my hubby, we should have a chat sometimes, because I'm sure we could share a lot of stories.
Sure we could.
Because a lot of the conflict that Sasha and I had, especially in our first years of marriage, we look back now and we recognize it was because we were forcing each other into these defined boxes, these defined roles, that Sasha was supposed to do X, Y, Z, and I was supposed to do A, B, C. And because we couldn't do that to the expectation that the other one had, that caused so much conflict. So letting go of that, I think it was about year 8 or 9 in our marriage that Sasha had come to this, we're a team and we don't have to be like everybody else. We don't have to do what other couples do. We can be us. That once we dropped that, which was the beginning of dropping these gender roles, that it was okay that we didn't have children and that I could pursue a career and that Sasha's actually better at house cleaning than I am. And that's okay. That's all right. Just to explore that out and drop forcing each other to perform in these ways that we were told were the ideal husband or the ideal wife. And like Proverbs 31 is the most heinous chapter in the Bible on what a capable wife is supposed to be. And all of these lists of duties that you are supposed to be formed, and then your owner can pronounce that they're happy because of that. Ah, such BS. I could have, yes, I just seen someone in the chat saying exactly how they feel about Proverbs 31. I hear you, Claire. Yes. You are right. Yes.
She says, honestly, F Proverbs 31.
Yes.
Or maybe Claire's mail. I'm not sure. Anyway. Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up about the wife. Like a client that I was working with recently, it wasn't even a religious issue, but I noticed that she kept exchanging between, I need to do these things to be a good wife, and talking about her husband as a partner. I want him to do these things as a partner. And I said, you know what, can you just like explain to me in your mind, what's the difference between being a good wife and being a good partner? And she took it home and did some journaling on it and came back and was like, whoa. So surprised to see that even though she considered herself a really kind of progressive or advanced person, that she still was buying into all of these things about how she needed to treat her husband and honestly what she needed to put up with to be a good wife. And when she compared that to being a good partner, it was very clear, this isn't working for me and he's not treating me like a good partner and I need to have some real honest conversations with him about how the relationship isn't working. But it was
just so powerful, isn't it? That word wife and husband. You said it earlier about reversing the roles and using non-gendered language. But those words, wife and husband, they take you straight to those gender roles of what a wife or a husband is supposed to be. So taking that away and referring to a partner, that's good. That's powerful.
Yeah. And I recognize that we have been referring mostly to heterosexual couples, but the same stuff plays out in same-sex couples as well, where I'm thinking about a friend that I have who would come to me sometimes and talk about what was going on with his partner. And I would over and over again, I'd be like, you're both trying to be the man. That's the problem here, is that you're both trying to enact this role of what it is to be the man in the relationship. And that's why you're having these huge conflicts. And if you think about each other as like, get rid of the role of you're trying to like be your dad or something, and just like be a partner. I love that the non-gendered term, because it gets rid of all of the assumptions that we have.
Yeah.
And I've worked with, same-sex female couples as well, where they get caught up on the wife and being really disappointed that my partner isn't being a good wife to me because of all these assumptions about how I thought that you were going to treat me once we were married, because now I have a wife. Yeah. And we could break that down a little bit and figure out, okay, but you two as individuals, what do you expect mutually from each other? We both give in this way. And what are the things where we're going to do some division of labor? And you can just kind of figure out what works for you. This is a fantastic tool. You can just Google it if you want to. Look up division of labor worksheets if you're wanting to kind of reorganize or just think through what are the assumptions that we have. And you can go through and look, because the division of labor worksheets will list out what are all the things that you need to do to run a household. And if you have kids, what are all of the things, all of the tasks that get done? And you can look at, okay, how do we divide it now and how do we want to divide it? And sometimes it can be really eye-opening for one partner to realize, oh, I don't pull my weight here. There's all these things that my partner did that I didn't realize. And I've also had, when I've given this assignment to couples that I work with in my practice, I've had people come back and be like, I feel so much more appreciative of my partner. Because there were all these things that they were taking care of that I just wasn't aware of. And it actually, just looking through the worksheet, even though they didn't have a ton that they needed to change, was a thing that brought them closer together, because it was like, wow, we really are a team in all these ways that I didn't see. So that's a real concrete tool for anybody who wants to kind of go through and re-examine this stuff. And when we're thinking about intimate relationships, I mentioned before the power with rather than power over.
Yeah.
And we also want to look at healthy relationships being mutual. This is, okay, I'm like Rebecca, the therapist now, quote some research here. healthy relationships are mutual. They are mutually beneficial, which means that both people's needs are being met. The relationship isn't just good for one person at the expense of the other. There's mutual accommodation so that we both are working to meet the other person's needs, to accommodate around preferences, to accommodate around schedules. Is one person always giving in terms of who picks up the kids or who takes time off or whose family gets visited for the holidays or, you know, those types of things. Like a healthy relationship is going to be mutual where there's give and take. And there's also mutual or shared decision making. And that's that power with again, instead of power over.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then
sounds like it's more like a team effort and less than a managerial type
Absolutely. 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 Okay. And then I have just a couple final thoughts on being patient with yourself while you're trying to unlearn and like figure out a new way of being. This is like learning a new language. You're learning new ways of talking about things. You're learning new ways of thinking about things. And when you're learning a new language, sometimes you're going to mispronounce things. Sometimes your grammar is going to be awkward and you're going to need to get corrected and you're going to need to check with some other people. And if you can think about the process that way, you open up so much more space for yourself to learn. I'm just learning. I'm learning a new way of being. And it's okay if sometimes it's a little awkward and I mess it up.
Yeah. Yep. I did that not long ago. An expression that I'm just so used to saying because you grew up with it. And I didn't realize until I thought about it how problematic it actually was. Boys will be boys. And at the time I said it, I didn't compute. But the person who was with me said, stop and think about that. And when I did, I was like, oh my God, what did I just say? I've just put people into boxes. I've just put people into these roles that it doesn't have to be that way at all. And so you're right, just cutting myself some slack that instead of actually judging that, I saw it as an opportunity to grow, that it was, okay, well, I'm not going to use that expression anymore because now I can appreciate where that comes from, that it's coming from these gender roles. And I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm not going to use that expression anymore. So then it becomes about personal growth. So I like that you're saying that just not to be too harsh, to be patient with ourselves, that we are going to make these stuff ups because that coding runs so deep.
It does.
It's just been there, always been there. And so it's going to take time to break that down.
And it will show up when you are stressed or depleted. You'll fall back into old ways of thinking. This gender-based bullshit may bubble up again, and you might find yourself wondering, maybe I was foolish to think that I could do this. See, I knew that it was wrong to be vulnerable in this way. And I think that if you know that that can happen, then you can be patient with yourself. And if you think you were exactly right in what you said there, Sherry, about this being like your earliest programming. Mm. And when we're super stressed out, our brains are going to take us back to, it's almost like you're filing back through what worked, what worked, and we go back to the first things that we learned. And again, if you know that that might happen, you can be patient with yourself, take care of your needs, recognize, okay, whoa, in my situation, it might be doubt about my business. Maybe I'm foolish. Maybe I shouldn't have done this. Maybe I should have just been a stay-at-home mom like I was taught, right? When those thoughts come to my head, I'm like, okay, that's a signal to me that something is off and that I'm stressed out. And so I need to go back and look at what are my needs and take care of myself and then just get myself back on track. Sometimes it can be helpful to like play the tape all the way through, technique from addiction recovery. Like, okay, so I had that thought, and where do I, if I actually go all the way with that thought, I'm not going to be happy as a stay-at-home mom. I tried it for like 6 months and I was miserable.
Right.
Oh yeah, I remember that. That's just this old programming showing up. Okay, and I also know that that's a signal to me that I'm stressed out and that there's some other thing that I need to do to take better care of myself. And I get myself back on track because that's where I'm happiest.
Right. So getting to know yourself that well allows you to give yourself a bit of self-therapy, to be paying attention to yourself, to realize where things are coming from, so that you can then look after yourself. Oh, this is blowing my mind, Rebecca.
Also, fantastic. Like, self-therapy, sure, because I'm a therapist. That's the way that my brain works. But it's also okay if your brain doesn't work that way and you need to go to a therapist to help you, give you that outside perspective and to help you sort through it.
To learn those totally techniques valid. Or skills. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Right. Because yeah. that is what it's sounding like, that it is a skill that you have to develop and work on. It's not something that's mm-hmm. going to become automatic. You've got to practice using these things, these tools,
right.
Really.
Right. And there's some like skill in self-awareness, which is where like a meditation practice can be really useful as well, that you can just observe what's happening in your body, in your mind, without there being judgment about it. Because I could easily go into a shame spiral if I noticed these thoughts coming up and then added some judgment and guilt on top of that. But I also can just go, oh, I noticed that's what's going on with me. Interesting. Wonder where that's coming from. I wonder what else is going on. And you know, some kind of mindfulness or meditation practice can be really useful in helping people develop that skill. And you're totally right. It's a skill. You practice it.
This isn't the first time the advice of working with some meditation skills has come up on the RFRX.
I know. I've brought it up before.
I know. And it seems to be a something that is really helpful to a lot of people too.
Yeah.
Rebecca, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover before we wrap up that I might have missed?
Or a final message?
Yeah, my final thoughts are just like, this is maybe just more, you know, Becca philosophy, I guess, but I think humans are awesome. I love meeting people. And I love seeing them find out who they are and love who they are and like shine. And so that's my invitation to you, is to figure out who you are. Feel free to keep the things that you were taught that work for you and to let go of the things that don't work for you and like just really embrace who you are as a person, because I think who you are as a person is beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm seeing lots of clapping hands, so I think everybody else is agreeing with the sentiment.
Good, because I can't see all of them. I just can see your faces.
Well, Rebecca, afterwards we have the hangout, as you well know. Do you have some time to okay, great, good.
Did I talk right through the Q&A section? I lost track of how much. Okay.
We actually just have a single question. I think that you covered this so well that we just have one single question.
While I
get the resources, Sherry, you want to have a conversation about the question?
Yes. So the question is a good one. What do the words masculine and feminine mean today?
Ooh. What do the words masculine and feminine
mean today?
My initial thought was the metaphors more than anything. If we can kind of just because our language is so tied to gender, especially like a lot of the European language, like there are gender specific nouns. Yeah. And it obviously probably came out of those old gender roles that have been around for thousands of years. But my initial thinking was that they're just metaphors these days. And I suspect a lot of the gender driven terms are going to slowly kind of disappear and work their way out of the English language as we grow and hopefully become a better species on this planet.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, for me, when I sit and think about it, masculine and feminine, I mean, outside of like grammatical stuff, they can mean, or they reference those traditional roles. And I don't think that that has to mean that there's not a place for them, but maybe we just put some qualifiers on there. And it also, maybe whether they're useful terms or not, depends on if there's judgment attached.
Yes.
Because I might say something like, I, as a woman, I enjoy some things that are traditionally masculine. Ooh. I do. I have some of those characteristics. I have some of those hobbies. And like, that's okay. There doesn't have to be any judgment to it. And the terms then just become useful language for describing what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Right? An adjective. Or if you say that someone is masculine, is that just a descriptor or is there a judgment, a value attached to it? And so I think there's still usefulness to them in that they call back to these scripts that we all are familiar with. And, you know, you can decide whether how you want to use the terms, I guess, and whether they're useful to you. You also could throw them out entirely from your vocabulary and have different ways of describing people. That's okay.
That sounds like it might be the better option. we have another question.
Yeah.
Is there a way to understand gender dysphoria without supporting harmful gender roles?
Again, I think that it is a useful term to describe that experience. But that doesn't have to be connected to a value judgment. And I think that especially in the mental health realm, that's like can sometimes be a controversial thing because in order to maybe get treatment covered by insurance, you may have to receive a diagnosis, the diagnosis of gender dysphoria, and that can feel pejorative, labeling like there's something wrong with you if you have this diagnosis. And in that sense, it definitely reinforces that traditional gender role stuff, like there's something wrong here that your internal experience doesn't match your genitalia. And I also know a lot of people, again, other mental health professionals who work with transgender folks, and other people who are non-binary who just talk about it as being a descriptor. This is a term that describes that experience, but it doesn't mean that it's bad. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the person, but we also do need to have some language that describes the experience that the person is having. I don't know if I fully answered that question. And again, I am completely open to being wrong because this is outside of my realm of expertise. So.
From my limited experience, it sounded logical what you said.
Thank you.
I can understand a bit of it. I noticed there's another question here too, Eric, on how could one differentiate in their mind the way religion skewed one's view of gender expression versus gender identity?
Okay, how can one differentiate the way that... I think the best way that I know how to do this is to get exposure to people who are outside of the religious group that you belonged to or that you're most familiar with. And again, it's pretty similar to what we were talking about before with switching the genders to kind of, you know, bring some of those unquestioned assumptions there. It's like, well, if I don't know the way that my religion impacted me, then maybe I need to go like talk to some people who aren't religious. Maybe I need to, and it doesn't even have to be conversation. I think that there is a lot of value in reading books, listening to podcasts, consuming media that are for, by, and about the, whatever the group is that you want to learn about. And that may help you to see I would pay attention to what comes up for you. Are you surprised by the things that you see? Are there things there that make you uncomfortable? And that might help you kind of tease out what are the things there that were influenced by your religion or maybe skewed the way that you saw who you are.
It's so important to consider religion in how we view the genders and how we view the roles, because I was listening, people may not be aware of a few things going on in Australia, but we have had in the first few months of this year, quite a lot come up about sexual assault and sexual harassment and violence towards women, even to the point of rape happening in Parliament House. And the woman that it happened to courageously spoke out about it. So there's the conversation around domestic violence or violence towards women has happened. It's happening a lot now in Australia. It's being talked about. I was listening to a podcast just this week about it by the former Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, our first and only female Prime Minister. And listening to the conversation, it was all very, very interesting and academic. They went into a bit of research, but they missed that at no point talked about the impact that religion has on this, because it underpins the whole thing on the roles that women think men should have and that men think women should have. And it does, it underlines all of it. So I feel like society now is approaching conversations, is having dialogue about these issues, and we need to. But they're not getting towards the heart of it yet. I'm not sure how we're going to get there. But anyway, I know I've just hijacked it to a slightly different topic, but it is related.
Yeah, and I think that those are really hard conversations to have when religious belief is still so privileged. In Western, I don't know about Australia, but in the United States, definitely, you know, religious belief is still very privileged. And yes. So I think that those are hard conversations to have publicly, because people's defensiveness about their religion gets activated.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very true. So we've got a lot of growth to do yet, but at least, at least in this format, we're having a really frank conversation about things that need to be discussed. So thank you so much, Rebecca. I've been just enjoying this so much.
Yes, thank you. It's one of my favorite things to talk about.
Yeah, I can imagine why.
Well, let's have you on to talk about it some more in the future. Ooh. How's that sound?
Sure.
Rebecca, thank you so, so much. But Dr. Ray, take it away.
Well, I just say thank you so much, Rebecca. You've triggered a whole bunch of memories in my life. I mean, I'm not a spring chicken, but I was around when Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, and I read it. And at that moment of only 14 or 15 years old, I realized, wow, my religion taught me about women isn't what she's telling me about women. And I had a hard time wrapping my head around that. It took me several years. And then the next thing you triggered was I took the very first women's studies course at my college in my sophomore year. And wow, was that an experience of I was the only male in the class of 17 other students and a female instructor. And so I got my little box blown open a little bit more there. And what I realized as you talked is how many times in my life, and this is not Daryl the therapist, this is just Daryl, I've had to expand my box. I've had to break the walls down. I had to reconfigure the box. And it was a damn box that somebody else built around me. I did not have anything to do with that box. It was my church mainly. And to some degree, my parents, I don't blame my parents for that, but I do look at the religion, built a very rigid box. I am very glad that I was able to get out of that box largely, but I still have things come back that I still have to remind myself, nope, that's the box. And I really appreciate the fluidity with which you describe things and helped all of us explore tonight. Because that's what I think that's what it's about, being more and more flexible in how we identify ourselves, how we identify other people, and letting people be who they want to be rather than trying to confine them in some preconceived notion. Anyway, I could go on and on tonight. Thank you so much for for doing all this. And I don't know how many times you've been here, like four times, I think. You're one of our regulars, and it's always worth it. Folks, if you appreciate what you've just heard here tonight, I hope you'll come back. We've always got good programming. And what blew my mind this week, I spent the whole week at the first international conference on religious trauma, and I listened to almost all the talks. I interacted with many of the attendees and speakers. But this is a big deal, and it's the first time this has ever happened. And about a third of the speakers there have been right here talking to us on RFRX. So we are getting top quality speakers coming and talking to us about shit. And, you know, mainly we can blame Eric and Amaya for that. I lay all the blame on Eric and Amaya for rounding up these great speakers like Rebecca. But if you do appreciate it, we hope you'll consider donating. We're a nonprofit 501c3. We have no membership. We have no way to fund ourselves except through people like you who appreciate what we're doing. And if you want to volunteer, that's another way of contributing to us. People like Helen are volunteering daily. I will say Helen volunteers daily here. In fact, there's almost not a day I don't see her volunteering, among several other people like Sherry and Eric. So not that everybody has to volunteer that much, but we're always looking for volunteers. All right, thanks, Sherry, for co-hosting for the first time. And by the way, you did an A-plus job. I will give you an A. I don't know whether Eric will or not, but I will. So, there you go.
I'll take that A-plus. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.